Very warm welcome to Bruegel's podcast live. It's an event and a podcast at the same time, The Sound of Economics. My name is Guntram Wolf and I'm the director of Bruegel, and I'm really delighted to host today a discussion on the macroeconomic implications of the war of Russia against Ukraine, what it all means in terms of the European, for the European economy. We will also hear, of course, views on what it means for Russia, what the sanctions means. And we do want to talk really about the economics and not about the geopolitics, nor about the war itself. I think there's lots of reporting on that already, and it's a very unpleasant reporting. So our work here really is as economists to clarify the implications on the economic side. And we want to start by really talking about the sanctions. Then we want to talk about the macroeconomic implications more specifically. And we want to also explore policy options, and in particular, the policy options on fiscal and monetary policy and also financial policies. All these policies will have to be reassessed in light of this very big shock that the war actually constitutes on the global economy. And I would say it is in many respects like a major negative supply shock, rendering energy prices much more costly, leading perhaps even to some real scarcity in energy. And therefore, of course, it has implications for inflation and for monetary and fiscal policies, which we want to explore. Now, I'm delighted to be today with two very dear friends, one former colleague and colleague, former director of Bruegel and colleague, so Jean Pisani-Ferry. He's a senior fellow at Bruegel. And of course, also let me welcome Luis Garicano, who is a member of the European Parliament for Renew Europe, and also professor of economics at the London School of Economics, if I recall correctly. And so we really want to explore these three blocks. So we start with sanctions, then we talk about the macroeconomics, and then we talk about policies. And we also want to give you, our audience, a chance to ask one or two questions. If you want to ask a question, please go on Slido and type in the code word sanctions macro, sanctions with an S, macro, and I will be able to read your questions on my smartphone, and we can discuss them here towards the end of this podcast. So perhaps we start with Luis on the sanctions, because Luis, you've been very active thinking about what it all means. And, you know, I would love to hear from you. What's your take on the effects of the sanctions? And, you know, do we go far enough? Should we go further? And how do you see the situation around the sanctions?
So I think there is the good and the bad. I think that I've been very, very impressed with the decisions to block the reserves of the Russian Central Bank. When we all started to talk about it, it seemed like a crazy, far-fetched idea that they wouldn't have the guts to install. And a few hours later, it went from absolutely impossible to a reality in a very short time. This basically means for our listeners that of the 650 billion roughly dollars reserves of the Russian Central Bank, half are unreachable. They've been joined by Japan, France, Germany, the Eurozone, the UK, and the US. Basically, what it means is that physical cash is very scarce. There's only maybe 12 billion between euros and dollars in Russia. Most of the reserves are in the form of accounts in these banks. And basically what these banks, with these central banks, are telling the Russian Central Bank is, look, you can't touch this money to protect the ruble. And what that's going to mean is that both in terms of the maintaining financial stability, maintaining the purchasing power of the ruble, etc., the Central Bank of Russia is going to be pretty handicapped. And they're pressing hard. And I will talk about the bad now, which is the big transfers of energy we are sending. So that's the best part. There is a little bit of a make-believe part with SWIFT, I think, because at the end of the day, yeah, we're excluding some banks, and that's going to be significant. But there, we are leaving other banks there, and the money, the payments can go through whatever hold you leave. So as long as some banks are open, it doesn't matter. You can just have an account with one of those banks and get it done. So this leads me to the third and last point, which is the energy. The reason I say the sanctions are not fully effective is that we are sending over, right now, over $1 billion a day to pay for gas, to pay for oil, to Putin, to Russia. So basically, the Russian Central Bank, what it's doing is it's demanding the importers, Gazprom and company, to use 80% of the reserves, immediately change them into rubles, thus generating a huge flow of reserves day after day that can be used and that is being used, obviously, to maintain the value of the ruble. So we are ourselves nurturing the impact of those sanctions by basically financing very richly the purchase of gas and oil. Of course, we understand, and we'll get into that in the next round, I guess, that Europe, particularly Germany and other countries in the East, are very dependent on Russian gas, not just for energy, but also for heating. But to me, either we are serious and we want to incur serious costs that I'm happy to mutualize and we'll talk later, or we should just not be playing this game.
John.
I'm exactly on the same line. I think, the sanctions have been effective in attacking the stock dimension, the chest of the Russian Central Bank. Now, there is the flow dimension, and the flow dimension is absolutely major in quantity terms. We're speaking of a country that had a surplus on the current account, even when gas and oil prices were very low. And that's how it built its reserves. Now, the price being five times of gas, being five times what it was, a year ago, it's been the flow is absolutely huge. So something like, 200, even you're saying more than 1 billion a day, but even in a sort of conservative assumption, 200 billion per year, which is enormous. Meaning that we have to be clear. If we are telling the Russians, we are paying the gas, but you can't use the money, then there is no point for them in exporting the gas. If we're telling them, we have a carve-out, you can use the money, we're making actually the sanction ineffective. So we have a choice to make. And I think in this regard, we have to be very clear about the sort of the game of chicken between Europe and Russia. Oil can be sold everywhere. Coal can be sold everywhere. Gas can only be sold where there is infrastructure to sell. And so Russia is dependent on the European market. So there is an asymmetry, and the asymmetry is in favor of Europe, because for Europe, imports of gas from Russia, they represent 9% of the total primary energy consumption in Europe. So this is important in certain countries. This is even major in certain countries. But for the EU as a whole, it's not such a big number. So by combination of cutting a bit the consumption of gas, diversifying sources of supply, and having the solidarity, in very concrete terms, in ensuring that member states in the EU can have access to energy, we can reduce the flow at least. But if we're not really serious about reducing the flow, we're not serious about sanctions.
Well, let me disagree on this point. Also, that we start having a good debate. I think it's not a surprise that limiting gas exports is widely seen as a counter sanction that Vladimir Putin wants to impose on us, and not as a primary sanction that we want to impose on Russia. And the reason is very simple. If we are cut off from gas, it's feasible to survive, but it's going to be quite difficult to get through the next winter, as we have calculated. And the solidarity within the EU is actually going to be very difficult also, because some gas pipelines are missing, etc., etc. But more fundamentally, the question is how much it would really hit Vladimir Putin. And let me just be very clear here. The main revenues that Putin makes are not from gas. I mean, he makes the revenues from oil, not from gas. Oil is much more important as a revenue generating machine than gas is. And that's why and as you both pointed out, I mean, oil is a global market and there will be buyers of oil. So it's going to be very difficult to actually limit the revenues he makes on oil unless you stop the oil tankers or you stop you prohibit him from using the revenues on the oil. So the key is the oil. And the gas is relatively small proportion of the overall revenues. Now, what is further, if there's no gas in Europe from Russia, of course, we will have to substitute away from gas. We will have to consume other sources of energy. And that's going to be coal and oil, and of course, nuclear and renewables. And so a stop of Russian gas will also mean global energy prices will go up. And usually the oil and the gas prices are quite linked. So it's actually quite possible that the increase in oil prices will even more than offset the lost revenues on gas. So I'm not sure that Europe would be well advised to really start on the gas. We should start on the financial sanctions, which we have done on the gas. I doubt it will be a strong hit on him, but it will be a bigger hit on us.
The reason that the financial sanctions are not really working as they should is because we have a carve-out. And the reason for the carve-out is not the oil, it's the gas. The real problem for Europe, the real source of dependency, the real place where he has us over the barrel is gas. We can buy oil anywhere. The same way he can sell it anywhere, we can buy it anywhere. The moment we limit our dependency on gas, and you're right, we need to work a lot on LNG, liquefied natural gas plants. We have a lot of capacity in Spain, which is idle. We need to build ways to bring that to Germany, etc. But the moment we start working on limiting that dependency on gas, we can actually raise the SWIFT sanctions to the real level at which we should be, which is basically excluding all banks, all payments from SWIFT. And then I think we're starting to hurt him also on the oil and the gas. I agree with you that the oil is a world market. Also, that's the reason why I don't think a lot of this gas demand from Europe, just 9% of energy of Europe, and reduce that by how much are we not going to be reducing with LNG, substituting with LNG, et cetera, et cetera. There were calculations before the war started that suggested that we can replace more than half of that LNG through LNG. So I do think this is a joke, Guntram. I mean, I think it's a joke that you say, oh, you know, we're putting all these sanctions, but here's a check that we're going to send you every day for over a billion. No, by the way, Jean,
You have to stop. You have to stop. At the end of the day, if you really want to be effective, you have to stop him selling the oil. And then
You can extort
the oil. We can put obstacles. I mean, it's going to be more.
Yeah, that's what you should do.
But it's not going to be sufficient because
there will be
someone willing to buy
compare the revenues on oil with the revenues on gas. I mean, he's making the revenues on oil, not on gas.
The point is, are you saying we should also be doing oil? In which case, of course, I think Jean and me are both going to say, of course.
No, or are you saying the oil?
We're going to try to do everything. I mean, the point here is that this is really a situation without precedent that is going to cost Europe much, much more than a bad winter. This is going, if he wins here, the next time it's going to be Estonia, it's going to be Lithuania, he's going to show he can take a NATO
that's
member.
That's why you have to take him on the oil and you have to.
And on the gas.
We agree. Let's do everything we can do on the oil.
Yes, as well.
Okay, so then that's
if we don't do on gas, we are on the losing side. So I think we should do gas, and it's going to be painful, no? But it's not going to be impossible. There is a Bruegel paper out saying precisely it can be done. I mean, it's difficult.
Well, of course, it can.
Fortunately, it's spring, so we don't. The need for gas is not as if we were in October. So we have time. We have time to organize the distribution of gas, as Wish was explaining, use the spare capacity, import LNG from the exporting countries. that we have to be very clear from the start. And if we're not clear from the start, we're going nowhere.
I really think you have to look at the general equilibrium effects and see how much this has an effect on the prices per se. I mean, so far, he is having a great crisis because everybody knows Russia is a main exporter. And as the exports become more delicate, everybody is stocking and the prices go up like crazy. So, we have to think very carefully about how much the oil price is going to go up as a consequence of stopping gas. That's the point I was making. Now, I haven't done the general equilibrium effects myself fully, but Europe is a major demand of Russian gas. And if that has to be substituted with oil, it will have implications on global oil markets. I would really focus much more on thinking about how can we increase global oil supply? I mean, can we not really armstrong Saudi Arabia into really producing much more and flooding the global markets with oil? That would be really the most effective sanction on Russia at this stage. So that's my view on this. But I don't know.
I think in terms that it's very hard to argue that he's having a great crisis. I mean, today the price of the Gazprom shares was 0.01, 1 cent. Went from $16 to a cent in the London market. The price of the main share bank, the main Russian bank, is at 1 cent. I mean, I don't think Russia is by any means having a great crisis. They're really hurting the sanctions.
The gas market.
The sanctions are hurting. The sanctions are hurting. And I think we need to really intensify dramatically those sanctions if we want to basically collapse the financial system, which is what the only hope we have of creating a fast enough crisis in Russia.
That let's talk about this. And I mean, I'd love to hear
just, you. Just a point, if I may. You can't have it both ways. I mean, you can't explain at the same time that gas is secondary for Russia and that it's vital for the global energy balance. I mean, if it's small, it's small. You're telling us, you know, if you do it, it's not going to be major for Russia, but it's going to be major for the price of oil. No, I mean, it can't be.
Agreed.
Why not?
I mean, because it's either or. Either it's big or it's small. But if it's small for Russia, it's even smaller for the world. So it's not going to change the prices, the general equilibrium.
I don't know. I mean, I think what we are seeing currently in the markets looks differently. But let's talk a bit about, on what it means for the Russian economy, what all of this means for the Russian economy, if we have a minute, because, of course, a lot, as you say, Luis, and I think I fully agree on that point, it is having already major effects on the Russian economy. I mean, we've seen the ruble literally collapsing. The banks that have been subject to sanctions rightfully have been, losing market capitalization to a massive extent. So this is already very, very serious on the Russian economy. So what... what's your take on how bad it is really for Russia and, you know, how much more it will take?
I think that the key is the cash that we are sending every day. I mean, as long as we are sending these quantities, by the way, I was going to say before, Jean, and I think the way the two quantities that we've seen are compatible is that the spring is coming and the total payments of gas are going to go down. And that's why the average is compatible with the daily flow. I think the sense that I have is that it's going to get very bad, but that it's not probably going to get to the point of collapse because of this. That's what we saw with the ruble. We saw a very, very large drop and then it's kind of stabilized. And we've seen that with other indicators. So, I think the Central Bank of Russia using the Chinese, the deposits in China, the gold and the flow of money arriving could just have enough to make it subsist at very bad and not it get catastrophic. We need catastrophic if we're going to have enough pressure on Putin to pull back. I mean, we need people in the streets to be asking Putin to pull back because their savings are volatilizing. And my sense is that the sanctions are biting, they're biting hard, but not getting to that point.
So how do you come, or Jean, do you see that differently? I mean, how do you come to the sense of where it's really bad and where it's just bad? I mean,
I'm only looking at the ruble.
The interest rate has gone up, has been doubled.
From 9.5 to 20, right. Yes.
Yeah, so people are starting to buy iPhones as a store of value. So it looks already, I mean, what is it that you think one could really try to achieve with further sanctions? And how
for me, it's the rule.
There's destabilization that's going on. And then there's a type of balance in which the Russian economy could find itself. Russia does not produce durable goods. I mean, Russia massively, it's an exporter of raw materials and an importer of durable goods. So for consumption, for equipment, it relies on the global market, and it relies on what's being supplied by Europe. So the question is, you know, if you're sufficiently effective, you're blocking that, and with visible consequences for output, with visible consequences for consumption, and with visible consequences, obviously, for inflation. So we have to think also the sort of end game in which the Russian economy becomes a sort of managed economy in which there is no market anymore. But the question of, you know, what the flow that comes in and what the balance that makes it possible to sustain a certain level of consumption and investment. We are sort of moving, I think, from the sort of high frequency, you know, shock effect to this question of where we're going. And it can be a war economy. I mean, we're moving into a war economy in Russia. We're moving increasingly into a war economy in Europe. And the reasoning there is different. I mean, it's not just about markets. It's also about underlying balances.
Benjamin, if I can go back to connect these two ideas, that I think that the financial situation, which I call bad but not desperate, I am looking at the ruble basically. I was expecting to be able to sink it more. Today, I think it's been just 3%. But I agree with you, Jean, on the long run. And I have a nice anecdote, which is from an aviation expert today in Twitter, going very carefully over the aviation market. And what basically he was explaining is, look, you need to repair these planes. You have normally pieces for 3 weeks. You don't have any pieces. GE already has said they're not repairing the planes. Rolls-Royce, same thing. None of the Western companies, they are Boeing and Airbus, basically are going to ship pieces or do repairs. Plus, they cannot fly over anywhere in Europe or et cetera. So basically, he was claiming that within 3 weeks, the whole system, the leases in Ireland are being canceled. Within 3 weeks, the whole aviation system of the US, of Russia will be disappeared, basically. So that's one example in which they get to this subsistence economy or this situation Jean was mentioning. But it's not the acute, it's more the long-term, the medium-term damage. It's not the acute. I would have liked to see after this Sunday, which is if really we had closed SWIFT and if there hadn't been payments coming in, I think we would have basically seen the banks, all of the banks collapse. And they managed to stave that off.
Right. Okay, so let's talk a bit about what it all means for the global economy and the European economy in particular. I mean, this is, of course, a major uncertainty shock. It's a major supply-side shock. And it's a major shock in energy prices, which really increases a lot the dilemmas that we are all confronted with. I mean, already prior to this war, there were very serious dilemmas for the central bank and for others by seeing that energy prices were driving up inflation, unemployment at record low. So it was time actually to hike rates. At the same time, the usual fragilities in the Eurozone were re-emerging. So a lot of worry at that stage. How fast can one tighten monetary and fiscal policies? And of course, now the situation gets more complicated because on the one hand, this entrenches the negative supply shocks that some were arguing were perhaps temporary, but now look perhaps even less so temporary, or I mean, a series of temporary shocks, I guess at some stage becomes a permanent shock. So there is a policy question, you know, do you need to tighten? But on the other hand, of course, the uncertainty really calls for doing exactly the opposite, namely more accommodative monetary policy, or continuing with the current accommodative monetary policy, so that fiscal policymakers actually do have the space to react and buffer some of the consequences of the current energy hike on European consumers, spend more on defense, etc. So this is actually quite a bad situation from a policymaking point of view. And so I'd love to hear Jean perhaps first on this, and then Louis, please, Jean.
It is a bad situation. I mean, it is coming on top of the situation we were seeing, where, you know, we had this inflationary shock, and it's more of it, clearly. And so we have the confidence shock, negative confidence shock. We may see a slowdown in global growth. And on top of that, we have this this major effect on prices. Now, in principle, what you should do, I mean, the standard theory is that if there is a stepwise increase in the price of energy, you don't have to react to the stepwise increase. The central bank has to react to the second round effect. So if it creates sort of more permanently more inflation, so which is what it's called looking through the increase. At present, so far, we don't see second round effects. I mean, we don't see a de-anchoring of inflation expectation, etc. But it's becoming increasingly difficult for the ECB, in a context where public opinion is worried about inflation, not to react. So the question is how to make the life of the ECB easier, and how to avoid this type of overreaction. I think the means have to be fiscal. I mean, the monetary policy cannot really do it alone. So there are ways in which households can be protected from these price rises. And even more, I would say, there are ways for fiscal policy or for regulatory policy to step in and to limit the rise in prices. So I'm speaking of a price intervention. But just to take an example, we have this electricity market in which the price of electricity is indexed on the price of the marginal energy, which is gas. So when the price of gas increases, the price of electricity increases across the board. This cannot be a good response in this type of situation. I mean, there is discussion on whether it's a good system in principle, but in this type of situation, it's not a good system. So you have to break this link between the price of gas and the overall price of energy, including electricity, even if electricity is produced with renewables, with nuclear, with coal, with whatever, but not gas. So I think that's the type of intervention we are forced to consider, even though, you know, we normally don't like this type of intervention.
So Jean, just because also there's a question, since you mentioned the renewable, there is a question here, and let me try to bring in some questions from our audience, because we are already coming to the last 12 minutes, which is about the renewables, and, you know, how quickly we can shift to renewables, and, you know, whether that can really at what time horizon this can make a difference. I mean, I think personally in the mix there's of course also the nuclear and the coal, and nuclear power plants are there and can be kept on instead of being switched off in the country I know best. So there's some scope to decouple there. But what's your take on the renewable? Because there was a question here in the audience. And then I come to you, Luis.
I'm 100% in favor of developing renewables very fast. But, you know, renewables need a backup when there is no wind or when there is no sun. And the standard backup is gas. So it's not really the answer. I think in the short term, we have to consider what you were saying. So sort of to postpone some of the changeover of the energy system, which is going to be a very difficult political decision for the coalition in Germany, because it's committed to accelerating this transformation. that we're not speaking, hopefully, of years. We're speaking of a, you know, short-term response to the situation. I think there are nuclear plants that are scheduled to close this year. I would say in this type of situation, I would just, you know, suspend the closure.
Luis, your take on the macro situation.
So my take is pretty similar to Jean. At the end, all the roads lead to a new European fiscal response. So my view is that the monetary response has been already very powerful, and that it has created the risk of inflation. I think when you do things and you don't pay for them, inflation follows. That's usually what happens. And I think we've seen some of that. So I think that the key now is to have the bank proceed very cautiously, the central bank, very cautiously. I wouldn't make big announcements about rate raises, and I wouldn't give a huge input to the inflation figure, which is going to be too high, obviously, in the next month. That will be the second big deviation. And in this current circumstances, I would be cautious with that. But at the same time, I think the fiscal authorities have to recognize this is a huge asymmetric shock. There are going to be countries which are very much affected, in this case, more the ones in the East that take all this gas. And we need to help together in Europe to develop an alternative. Jean has written a very nice think piece already, thinking through how much it would cost. To think about alternatives, to start to change structural changes, to make sure that we have the LNG capacity for next winter. And all of these changes are going to cost money. I think it has to be European money. The real big elephant in the room for Europe is still the same big elephant that you and Jean and me and many others have been worrying already for 12 years, which is the euro crisis, where spreads take off from each other, and people start to worry again about what can happen with the euro. And the way to avoid that is we need, I think, to have at least some flexibility in QE, in quantitative easing. Sorry for the audience. That I think this idea of the reinvestment, just with reinvesting, is going to be enough. I don't see how, and I would love to hear Jean and you on this, how just taking the bonds, the money that we get from stopping QE on German bonds and kind of letting them run off, taking that money and investing it into Spanish and Italian bonds. I don't know how long that is politically sustainable, but Guntram, you know much more about that political sustainability than I know from the German perspective. But this idea that, sorry, I'm making it maybe a bit too complicated. Let me see if I can make it very, very easy. The central bank said until a week ago, we're going to raise interest rates. In order to do that, we have to stop QE. But don't worry, when we stop QE, we still have to reinvest all the money that all the investments in bonds from the different countries that can due and that we cancel, and all this money that we invest will give us the ability to do stuff. And what I'm trying to argue here is that's probably not going to be enough to control spreads if we have big fiscal shocks in certain countries. And that's why I would continue keeping some QE, even if interest rates have to move. And I would hope that the fiscal response is European and not national.
But I mean, so basically, if I understand you correctly, you would probably not raise rates or decide on the raising of rates and delay getting out of QE, but at the same time really accelerate with a European financial instrument, so that we are less worried about spreads. And the European financial instrument is also something, if I may self-advertise here, a recent piece that I wrote with a few colleagues in foreign affairs, where we are actually saying we need some sort of a European next generation EU. It can be relatively mm-hmm. small, but something to help compensate
totally.
and actually keep unity, geopolitical unity, also in the EU on this. And I think the logic is very simple. I mean, it's a geopolitical confrontation, and if Europe wants to use its geopolitical force, it has to stay united, and that means also some internal side payments might have to be might be needed. But again, I think I would love to push you both a little bit more on the fiscal side. And I mean, I do agree with you that the ECB has to be very careful because of the spread issue. Now, at the same time, what we know now is that this will cost a lot of money for the taxpayers, right? I mean, it will cost a lot of taxpayers money to help households compensate for higher energy prices. So there we are already talking for countries like Italy, double-digit billion numbers. Then we will have additional defense spending, which is Germany has just basically decided it wants to have some sort of a golden rule on defense spending, alongside the kind of golden rule they have already on green climate spending. So there are major fiscal implications, major fiscal decisions. And so how do we square all of this? And can we really just say we accept higher inflation and, you know, we put it on the savers and the small incomes that will lose out from higher inflation? So how do we deal with this, Jean?
No, first of all, I mean, you know, the fiscal dimension, it is unavoidable. And you can, I mean, defense spending, we're speaking of 0.5% of GDP for most of Europe, if not all of Europe, in the course of, you know, 2-3 years annually. I mean, you know, and a stepwise increase of this investment into securities that was completely unexpected. Then we have the short-term cost of refugees. If we have, you know, a few million refugees in Poland, we've got to help the refugees. We have the energy dimension and the rebuilding of the energy infrastructure. And we have the short-term measures to sort of offset the implication of these price increases. So we're speaking of, you know, significant money. We're speaking of 1-2% of GDP in the short term in terms of additional toll. So the question is, as you said, I mean, who is going to pay for it? Eventually, this means higher taxes. This means, you know, we have to pay permanently. We're speaking defense spending is going to be permanent, I mean, as far as I can see. So there needs to be permanent revenues in front of it. And this is to be added to the additional investment on the green transition, which on the public side is about 0.5 percentage point of GDP, as you have yourself calculated. So we're speaking of a permanent increase by 1% of GDP, or lasting increase by 1% of GDP.
So tax increase.
So that, you know, in the short term, it's debt. I mean, we're not going to raise taxes at this very moment. It will be tested in the market. So that's why effectively the response of the ECB is extremely important. And I see no reason why the ECB shouldn't be able. I mean, the ECB has a huge portfolio of sovereign bonds. I mean, it can also reshuffle partly its portfolio. I mean, there's nothing that prevents it in principle in the BEP program. Right? In a way, it's a sort of spread control, but I'm not in favor of a spread control permanently, but no, in this type of situation, we're speaking of it. I mean, it was done in the COVID crisis de facto. It has to be done in this crisis also de facto.
I mean, for me, Jean, it's a question of political feasibility. If you think it's feasible, I think it's a good idea economically. Question about it. So Guntram, I mean, I would want to add one thing to what John is saying, which I fully support what he said. So the question is, how do you combine medium-run, long-run fiscal discipline with the kind of expenditure, debt finance expenditure we're talking about, 1-2% of GDP, which I think is a pretty reasonable ballpark if you include defense. And I think the kind of thing that I've been arguing for, you saw the Vox EU paper that I published under precisely John's editorship, has to have a credible combination in which Europe says, look, we are doing this as Europeans. We need to buy similar components. We need to do all these defense spending. The refugee is a European problem. The energy is a European problem. We're going to do this as Europeans. But we need you countries to be serious about taxes, because if you're not serious about raising this money, I mean, all the bets are off. Then we are just going into a path which we know where it finishes, in Venezuela or whatever. Mm-hmm. So the kind of solution I was arguing is, you tell countries, as long as you're doing certain things that we can discuss, which have to do with an expenditure rule, etc., you're in good standing. We are going to let you use this for the defense expenditure for refugees, X, Y, Z. Okay, I don't care exactly. I was thinking of environmental expenditure, but it can be broader than that. But the important thing is linking the debt finance expenditure that we need today with rules that are enforceable and that are enforced. And I think sticks don't work. We have found out already sticks don't work. You cannot go to a parliament of a country and say, if you don't do this, we're going to take this away from you, because voters don't accept it, parliaments don't accept it. But you can say, look, here's 20 billion for next year.
Condition.
This is the condition.
I
think this is very, very clear, and I think we all agree. And in the short term, debt will play a role to smooth the effect. I mean, this is a very strong immediate shock, and the medium term might be, I mean, let's hope that energy prices will not forever stay where they are. So some of the current expenses can be smoothed. And in that sense, we should have debt instrument. And I personally think we need a European debt instrument to really deal with this from a geopolitical point of view also, and, you know, to remain united vis-a-vis Russia in this situation. Perhaps the very last question which we got is on the war economy. And I think, Luis, you mentioned it, or Jean, I don't remember, the term war economy, and what the war economy term would, what does that mean actually for the EU?
It was Jean who used it.
I mean, the war economy in Russia, I see, but in the EU, there's a question by Katharina Gnat.
It's obviously an exaggeration. But what I mean by that is that there's a sort of standard reasoning in some cases does not apply. You know, in a war economy, you have a very different assignment of your tools to the different goals. And that's a bit the situation we're finding ourselves in. That's why I was saying, you know, use fiscal policy to limit the consequences, the effects of price rises. Normally, you wouldn't do that in a normal situation, but in this type of situation, I think it's necessary. So that's what I mean. You know, more sort of a, you know, government-driven allocation, less room for market mechanisms temporarily. I think it has to be accepted. That's a sort of a different type of rules of the situation we're finding ourselves in. But I, we know, for example, if you think longer term, I wouldn't say, and I think that's a danger that's coming, that everything has to be done internally, that, you know, we have to isolate ourselves from the rest of the world, that we have to end globalization. I think this is nonsense. We have to think more in terms of resilience, in terms of autonomy, but we should remain an open economy, and we should remain fundamentally market-driven economy.
The question, Jean, where that might be open to consideration is, do we want, as in the past, to be open market economy also with respect to trading with dictators and autocrats? I think what this has put into question is this idea that we can separate trade from politics. And I think that we will have to reevaluate after this crisis, I think, the democratic conditionality, if you want, of our trade agreements.
Good topic for our next podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's so many topics we could talk further about. I mean, I would have loved to also hear your views on, you know, sanctioning further the oligarchs, and, you know, whether we really are tough enough on them, and what it all means for Europe. So any quick views on that? If you have a quick view on that, please let me know.
I do the customary British bashing in these things. I mean, if you look at the list of crown properties and crown territories and all that, I mean, okay, just three facts. One, you know that very few countries have as much wealth concentrated on very few people. Second, very, very few countries have the few people that concentrate their wealth have it offshore. All these oligarchs have taken their money offshore. And third, all these offshore locations are ours. The crown territories of the UK, their territories of the United States, their territories of some European countries. This is a piece of cake if we want to do it. So exactly. I think that we have to do much more.
Yeah, there is a, fascinating research by Gabriel Zucman showing, you know, Russia in comparison to other countries. This is just incredible how much wealth is outside, how much is held by tiny minorities. So I think that's something that has to be tackled.
Thanks for the quote, because I didn't mention
thank you so much for being clear also on this point, which I really think is key. I mean, we cannot allow the rich of Russia to get away with this. The rich that, in particular, the ones that have been part of the Putin machine. So this needs to be very much on top of the sanctioning list in my view. And Jean, you want to say one?
Yes.
One more word, and then I want to conclude.
Under the rule of law. Yes.
The rule of law is
easily feasible.
I think what Gabriel and Gabriel Zucman and what Piketty want is a confiscatory tax, and I think I would love to find a way to make that feasible. And to be absolutely honest, I'm working on that. I hope nobody posts some polonium in my drink for saying that.
No, I thank you both. This is really important, and I really think we have talked about so many things, but I think we agree we need very tough sanctions. Russia needs to feel it. The Putin regime needs to feel it. We agree that macroeconomically this will have major implications, and we also agree that policymakers will need to show some ingenuity, some staying together on the policy front in fiscal and monetary policies to really smooth the effects of this major war right next to our doors. I think there will be more opportunities to discuss further in the coming weeks. Next week, we will host a podcast with Sergei Guriev to hear from him on the impact on Russia and how he sees the situation. And I'm sure there will be many more issues coming up in our podcast series and elsewhere. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you, Jean. Thank you, Luis. It was great to discuss with you.
Thank you. Thanks for your time. Always happy to be.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.